Welcome to the Human Friendly Workplace Podcast. I am your host, Jason Lauritsen, keynote speaker, author, and employee engagement fanatic. In each episode, we'll bring you stories from leaders and organizations who are succeeding by making work more human. These stories will inspire and equip you to do the same for your employees. This podcast is powered by the good people at Small Improvements who share my passion for making the workplace more human friendly. Small Improvements creates technology to help you promote the ongoing conversations at work that people crave. Clients love their lightweight, flexible approach to feedback and performance. You will too. Check them out at small-improvements.com. That's small-improvements.com. Enjoy today's episode. So I am really excited for our podcast today, and I know I say that probably every podcast because we've had some really great stories, but today is particularly unique. Today we're going to talk about Menlo Innovations. And Menlo Innovations is a software development company in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and there are a lot of interesting things about Menlo, as you'll find or if you do research, including the fact that they use a high-tech anthropology process in their development of software and a variety of other things that we're not going to have time to get into today, because today we're going to really dive into the unique way that Menlo organizes and manages work. It's so unique, in fact, that they started, once people started learning about how they did it, they started getting so many requests for, you know, to learn about it and for visits that their founder and CEO, Richard Sheridan, actually wrote a book about it. And he ultimately called it Joy Inc., which you can go pick up and buy on Amazon or your favorite bookseller. It's an amazing book and I'd highly recommend it. It's got all the sort of what, why, and how in it. So if you're intrigued today about the conversation, go grab a copy of the book or visit their website, look them up, Menlo Innovations. But today we have a special treat because most of our conversations on this podcast are with those who design or manage the work experience for others. But today we get to actually see the work experience at Menlo through the eyes of those who are living it and experiencing it every day. So my guests today are Chris Hutchins and Michael Krebs, who are developers at Menlo. I'm so excited you're here. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thanks for having us, Jason.
Awesome. So let's start with learning a little bit about you for some background. So Chris, I'll start with you. Can you share with us a little bit about you and what you do at Menlo?
Yeah. So I began my journey at Menlo August of 2015. So about 2.5 years in here at Menlo. I'm a software developer as my primary role, and just some background on myself. I have a BS in computer science. And
cool. Thanks. What about you, Michael?
Yeah, so I'm relatively new at Menlo here. I've been full-time since the start of this year, and I was in for about a month before that during the interview process. Before this, I spent about a year professionally as a software developer. And before that, I taught myself computer science. So that's my background.
Cool. So we have kind of two different perspectives. Chris, you've been there for a while. Michael, you're seeing things through new eyes. So it'll be interesting to, I guess, see how your perspectives are different or how they align. It's a very different way of working, I suspect, from where you had worked in the past. Before we get into that, Chris, can you give us a little bit more about Menlo and the business, just to help us maybe have some context for the organization and what you do?
Yeah, so Menlo Innovations is a software development firm. We have roughly about 35 to 40 employees here, you know, varying from different roles. We've got high-tech anthropologists, as you had said earlier. We've got quality advocates, software developers, project management staff, and the ins and outs of the, you know, a traditional like office type staff members, you know, payroll and that sort of stuff. But essentially, Menlo is a software development firm. We go on engagements. We send our high tech anthropologists out into the world to discover the ins and outs of the working environment of which we are trying to work with our clients on projects. They will go in and discover, you know, the ins and outs of the users in the real world workplace to get context. They will bring that information back, design a solution to whatever problem the client's trying to solve, and then the developers will step in and develop with the particular situation for them. That's pretty much the high level of, you know, Menlo as a whole.
Cool. So it sounds, I mean, that high-tech anthropologist obviously is an interesting, obviously a really interesting take on software development. But in general, you're building and designing custom software. I think what is interesting about your story, when people start looking into or learning about Menlo, as I did, is one of the things that jumps out immediately is the way in which you do work, which is that you work in pairs. You, especially with software development, you work in pairs, which is a very, I think, a unique and novel way of developing software. It's really unique to you, as I understand it. I'm sure others have started to emulate it, but can you talk a little bit about how that works? Like, what, you know, how does it work to write code or to develop software in pairs or to work in pairs at Menlo?
Yep. So, you know, essentially we've got, so if Michael and I were paired together, we'd sit down at the table that's been designated as part of the workspace for the particular project we're working on. The only equipment we will really have available to us is a single keyboard, a single mouse, and a single computer. And we'll, mm-hmm. we will work together. It's kind of a two brains as one kind of operation where we collaborate with each other and then take turns kind of at the keyboard to program. You know, one person will be driving. We call it driving. They'll be at the keyboard and the mouse and implore their ideas. The other person will be watching them and driving their ideas through them in combination with also like, you know, checking to see what they're doing as they're doing it and provide insight as needed. And we sort of just kind of switch off with that type of role mindset, switching from driver to observer, constantly bouncing ideas off of each other, and the baseline examples of kind of an approach that we do. So we do test-driven development here in combination with the pairing and the software development. For those that may not know what that is, the test-driven development means we actually write a test of expectations of what we want the code to do. We write those tests, we watch them fail, and then we basically add just enough production code to make those tests pass. That way, we know what we're getting from the production code that we're writing alongside the fact that the production code that we're adding doesn't break any other portions of the app. So with that in mind, one of the approaches that we like to do as pairs is we will have one person write the test for the production code, and then we'll kind of play a little game of ping pong where one person will take a turn to write the test. The other one will kind of write the minimum code to make it work, and we'll just go back and forth kind of like that. There's obviously variances to that, different approaches. Someone might drive like for the morning and then and the other one will drive in the afternoon. You know, there's different ways to approach that, but that was one of the first versions of that I experienced here.
So what is the argument behind why coding in pairs or working in pairs like this is better than working individually?
So there's several benefits, right? You know, when you're kind of working by yourself, you might, you know, long day, kind of get dragged down, you know, the energy may not be there. Having a pair partner is kind of nice to have because they're one of the responsibilities as a pair partner is you want our goals is to make the pair partner look good. So the other pair partner bringing in energy, keeping things going, kind of monitoring each other. And we're both looking out for each other. So, you know, we're kind of doing this all at the same time, but having another voice to bounce ideas off of that's not necessarily just google.com and hoping that you're searching for the right thing, right? Talking to the walls, like you've actually got a person and a team for that matter to bounce ideas and things off of. If it makes sense, do it. If not, let's review it. 200% accountability is another thing that pairing introduces to our workflow. And what that basically means is that like when we're programming, I have an idea of implementation, right? But I have to convince my pair partner to not only agree with it, but also be on board with how we're going about doing it. So because of that, like the actions that I do, if Michael's my pair partner, he will hold me accountable. Everything that he does, I'm also accountable for him. So it's like a checks and balances, and that's what the 200% accountability is for. We also don't write, as a rule here at Menlo, we also do not write production code unless both pair partners are present. So there's that as well.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that it allows us to be extremely flexible as far as who can work on which projects. So we usually have four or five different we could have as many as like five or six different projects going on at the same time. And a lot of times the needs of our clients will change pretty drastically, like from day to day or week to week. So we'll need to pull people on and off different projects. And one of the things that pairing allows us to do is it increases the rate of knowledge transfer between developers like exponentially. So you can bring someone on that's never worked on a specific project before. And if they're pairing with someone who's been on, who's more experienced with that project, they'll be able to get up to speed much, much faster than had they just been, you know, handed the code and told to like get going. So it allows us to be extremely flexible and agile as far as like resource planning and meeting our clients' needs.
Do you stay with your, I mean, when you are assigned in a pair, how long do you stay in that pair? Is it a long-term pairing or do they rotate fairly regularly?
The typical way that we assign pairs is that you'll stay for a week in a given pair, which is the length of an iteration here at Menlo, generally speaking. It could vary. Sometimes you'll get, you know, switched on and off a pair like as needs change, but the baseline is to change every week, and you end up essentially pairing with everyone at some point.
Hmm. Uh-huh. So once a week, so every week you're paired with somebody new. At least in most cases, you're paired with someone new. That seems, as someone from the outside looking in, like not only do you're going to be working with this person, as I understand it, you're working in, you know, fairly close quarters with this person over the course of, you know, for that 40-hour week together. But then next week you start over with somebody new, and there's different, you know, work styles and work preferences and that. Like how do you manage that? Because that feels, you know, that almost seems like there would be kind of a learning curve each time you find a new pair or you come into a new pair. Like what has been your experience with that in terms of rotating from one pair to the next? How do you make sure that you can kind of productively, you know, get to work and like, how does that happen? I'm curious what your experiences have been.
So I'm going to have to rely on actually the culture that Menlo has built in to kind of answer your question.
Okay.
You know, as part of our hiring processes, as part of the culture, as part of the people that we have here on staff, there's a heightened level of like trust and ability to be kind of vulnerable. And there's a collaborative element to the culture that has been built here, which kind of allows us to be able to kind of switch pair partners, you know, to what Michael's point, where we switch at the end of the week. You know, I know, like, even if it's a person that I haven't spent a whole lot of time with, like, I know that there's that baseline value of trust that we share culturally throughout everybody here at Menlo, to that I know that, you know, we might have differences of personality or we might have, you know, differences of ideas and stuff like that. But I know because they've gone through the 3-week trial, because they've gone through the one day, because, you know, they've been given feedback and responded accordingly. Like, all these things just pave the way for me to know that every person that I'm going to pair with is kind of like-minded in the sense that, you know, it's okay to say, no, I don't know these things. It's okay to present ideas and not know that you're not going to be like immediately shot down or, you know, treated in a way that might make you feel like not wanting to participate later. You know what I mean? All these elements are kind of tackled through our culture, which then allow us to be able to pair together and just work in an environment where those type of fears or those type of reservations exist a lot less. And
got it.
Yeah.
So the culture, and we'll dive into a little bit more about what that looks like or how that's specifically supportive. But I'm curious, Michael, as somebody who's new, what's been the hardest part for you in terms of in learning how to work this way as part of a pair? What's been the most challenging part?
I think probably the hardest part is just staying engaged, like actually engaged for 8 hours a day. I think probably if you like ask software developers like how many hours are you actually like completely productive? That answer is not going to be 8 hours, but part of the, when you're working in a pair, you have to stay focused though. That's part of the benefit, is like both people are pretty much laser focused the whole time in a way that you aren't if you're working alone. So it is, at the beginning, it is very like you know, kind of exhausting. I get home and I'm like, man, that was a lot. Like, so that is a lot to get used to.
So what's been the most surprising sort of benefit of working in pairs for you? Like, what have you found about working that way that was surprising, that that was awesome, that you didn't expect to be that way?
Yeah, I think just the ability to be flexible and to like be able to switch tasks very quickly is something that I'm surprised I was able to do as quickly as I've been able to. Since before, like a typical problem, I think if you ask developers, like, will be, they'll say like they hate getting interrupted because then like whatever you're working on, you forget what you were doing, and you have to spend 15 minutes just like, okay, where was I, and like get spun back up. When you're kind of working in a pairing, you're working out loud and like in this kind of collaborative way, it's a lot harder to get. It's harder to snap out of that when you get interrupted than it is if you're working alone. So that's a benefit that I hadn't thought of before.
Cool. So one other. So in the pairs, just so that, as I understand, you have the pairs that you work, and then your pairs then actually work then as part of a team as well, correct? I mean, there's sort of, you have, it's not just the pairs working independently, but you work as part of a team, sometimes on projects or sometimes on a variety of projects. But do I understand that correctly, that there's sort of a team structure that exists around the pairs as well?
Yeah, if you can kind of picture in your mind like a store floor, per se, like a factory floor, just open, no columns, no walls, no anything. We will group several tables together and like just form like one massive table. Think of it as more like a Thanksgiving table kind of approach, right?
Sure.
And we'll put, you know, a pair of chairs at one spot and a pair of chairs at another with each computer. But the point is like that whole table or that whole area all connected there represents the project. So if we're working on like a particular project, all the pairs working on the project are literally also sitting like right next to you at the same dinner table, having the same conversation with you.
Sure.
Or next to you, so that at a moment's notice, if Michael and I are going over a plan, you know, and another pair is kind of working in the same area of the code, or they know some information that maybe we don't, they can instantly like interject. You know, add their thoughts, course correct, whatever the situation might be. And that just adds to the level of the cooperation and the collaborativeness that you may not get if we're all working in individual cubicles or,
sure,
you know, in different offices or, you know, things like that.
Got it. Now, based on some of the reading and research that I've done about your organization, as I understand it, you're using agile and an adopted kind of agile method in a lot of ways. And so what that means, if I understand, is that there's not sort of a traditional management structure in terms of the, you know, the traditional hierarchy where you would have a, you know, a manager, a supervisor who is responsible for you and gives you all of your feedback and makes all of the decisions about your team, but that you sort of operate more as a sort of, I would call it sort of a self-managed team or a mutually managed team in that way. First off, I guess, do I understand that sort of correctly, that kind of the project is the boss or the work is the boss kind of in terms of how things are organized? But if that is true and there's not a traditional manager in place, can you talk about how do you get feedback on your work? How do you know if you're doing good work, both, you know, the code you're creating, but also like how you're interacting with each other, what kind of teammate or pair you're being? Like, how do you do feedback and get feedback on your work when you don't have that traditional structure?
So yeah, I think you're essentially right in the structure you're describing. So Menlo is very flat, a very flat hierarchy, and very democratic. And I think so everyone's responsible for giving each other feedback. And so that happens in a couple of ways. Like, it can happen in like a very formal way where we'll have like basically scheduled feedback, like meetings over lunch, where people will, you know, people that you've worked with regularly will, you know, sit around and give you feedback and for an hour. And also just on a day-to-day basis, anytime you're working with someone, you can be like, oh, I think that, you know, it's good that you're doing that, or maybe you should work on this. So it's kind of just a constant, basically you're always getting feedback from everyone you're working with. And people are since we built this culture of trust, we all, and like openness, we're all like willing to tell each other things that I think it might be awkward or weird in other places, or like seem like something you wouldn't necessarily do, but we like trust each other enough to be like, hey, like this is something you should be working on. And we'll know that the other person is like open enough to accept that feedback and actually be willing to work on it.
So I'm curious, you mentioned this feedback, this formal structure of feedback over lunch or whatever. Can you talk a little bit more about how does that work? You said that's a formal kind of process that you can use. Can you describe how that works?
Yeah. So we traditionally call it a feedback lunch, and basically anybody here can request one, right? So it's not like limited to just like newer people, or you've had one last month, you can't have one. No, anybody can call one. And essentially what it is you open up, you basically invite like 5 to 6 other people from Menlo, varying the roles. Like, so, you know, Michael and I are both developers, and if either one of us held one of these feedback lunches, like it wouldn't be just all developers in the room. We would invite like some of our developers that we've spent a lot of time with. We might invite one of the high-tech anthropologists, one of the quality advocates, and one of the project managers, you know, kind of get vary it up. And essentially we sit in the room. It kind of gives us the opportunity to give like a high level how we're doing, how we feel, plans we have, you know, maybe some problems that we're trying to address, you know, some things that we've gotten feedback on previously, and we're just giving an update or telling people how it goes, right? And then the side will flip, and we'll start getting some real in-depth feedback from all these different voices from around the factory. You know, we pair with developers pretty much consistently, so we're almost always getting feedback to that end, right? But the opinion of maybe a high-tech anthropologist or a quality advocate or project manager, you know, we may get feedback in the moment when something happens, whether we need to work on something or that we did a great job and how to tweak it maybe. But it's interesting getting some of those insights that you may not necessarily normally get, you know, from the person you're working with next to you all the time. So it's nice to get those other viewpoints and other context. And essentially, you know, we sit in there and for an hour, usually over lunch, and we'll just talk about things. We'll talk about, you know, how we're doing on our roles and levels. Like, we'll kind of discuss maybe briefly about, you know, how we're doing at whatever level we're at and things to work on to move up, you know, that those kind of conversations may or may not be included in that meeting. But that's pretty much the gist of a lunch and learn, or sorry, a feedback lunch.
So I have to react to that, because I know that there's probably people listening that are thinking, you know, the thought of inviting 5 or 6 people, you know, their peers, to come together for lunch and give them feedback sounds probably horrifying, right? They, you know, just based on past experiences with feedback, I actually know of organizations that have tried things like this and have abandoned it because it didn't work for a variety of reasons. People left feeling defensive, or they didn't get good feedback out of the process. People, you know, couldn't give or didn't know how to give good feedback. Why does this work at Menlo? What is it that makes, I think this is maybe where we connect back to the culture again, but what is it about Menlo that makes this kind of process work, that it feels good? Or that you would want to request to sit in a room with your peers and get feedback provided to you?
So as far as like, and I'll speak to my experiences, Michael can join in with what, you know, how he's felt about it. I know I've had 2 feedback lunches. The first feedback lunch that I had, I was kind of in the same ballpark. It was kind of a semi-terrifying thing. I didn't know, I haven't had one, so I don't know what to expect, right? I was fairly new. So the concept, you know, coming from a place where I was working by myself, I wasn't used to the idea that I could not know something or fall short maybe a little bit on expectations on something or something, right? And not worry that my job was in jeopardy because people want me to succeed here, right? So, but being not fully used to that yet, like right out of the gate, that made this an interesting thing. And I think to your point, like I have to play the culture card again. You know, we've built an environment that really does look out for each other. You know, we strive to make our pair partner look good. Our hiring process literally is you want to get the other guy hired. You pair when we do the hiring, and we want you to get the other guy hired. Right. So there's all these building blocks lead up to this environment and this culture to build this like safety net, if you will, to allow people to be vulnerable, to allow us to trust each other, to allow us to open ourselves up, be able to hear some pretty critical feedback at times. Right. But we know deep down inside the team just wants you to succeed, and they feel that it's better that you know about it, can work on it. Right. And they'll help you. You know, whatever you're working on, they'll provide tips on how to help. So yeah, I think it really boils down to the culture that we've built and being able to rely on it in these type of situations to get people to go. Mike, go ahead, Jason.
No, I was just going to ask Michael if he's had either had the opportunity to have a feedback lunch or be a part of a feedback lunch yet, sort of what that experience was like as someone new.
So no, I haven't yet actually, but during the hiring process, you go through a 3-week trial where you're essentially you're working on real projects as a developer, but you're, you know, just on a trial basis. And generally around once a week, you end up with all the people you worked with, you have like a little mini like feedback session for like maybe 15 minutes where you just go over like, okay, these are, you know, the things that we think you need to work on. These are the things that you're doing well. Mm-hmm. So even though I haven't gone through that specific process, I have been involved in basically both getting and receiving feedback basically constantly while I'm here. And I mean, it's pointed out things to me that I didn't really realize that were things that I was strong at and things I didn't realize that I was weak at. So it's really one of the more valuable things here is that we're all willing to basically build each other up in this way, I think.
That's really cool. And it's really exceptional. The ability or to create a culture where people not only can, but are willing to share that kind of feedback and receive that kind of feedback in a constructive way, I think is pretty remarkable. Connected to this or similar to this, I understand that you have kind of a peer-driven promotional process in terms of how people can advance, you know, through their career, find sort of advancement in their careers. Can you talk about how that works and the visibility and kind of the process for how someone gets promoted or moves up, I guess, in their career or along in their career at Menlo?
So just to kind of set the stage for everyone listening in, Menlo, because of the flat organizational design, because we want everything to be as transparent as possible around here, one of the things that feeds into what Michael and I will talk about our promotion process here at Menlo is the fact that everybody knows what level you currently are. And in turn, everybody also then knows how much you make. And I just wanted to lay that out, like with all of those.
Sure.
It's that much of an open environment here where everybody knows, you know, what everybody makes. It's not a secret, right? We have a chart on the wall. Mm-hmm. We have a roles and levels chart on the wall, which is kind of just an artifact to make it easier for everyone to know where they are level wise. I could go into a whole 15-minute discussion about the entire chart. And in fact, I think we may have last time we visited, Jason. So forgive me there. But the quick summary that I'll just throw out for the audience here is essentially we've got starting from the beginner entry level for Menlo, we've got the associate level, we've got then the consultant level, the senior consultant level, and the principal level. Each of those tiers, if you will, are broken up into the associate level has three actual levels, right? Mm-hmm. Consultant, senior consultant, and principal have five levels. So you can kind of see, you know, there's three levels of, you know, associate one, two, three, then you go on to consultant one and so forth.
Got it.
So with that system in mind and the whole like 2% accountability and the team wants you to succeed, yes, we have a peer-based team decision around promotions. And I also throw out, it also revolves around the same decisions to the unfortunate opposite spectrum where we have to let people go. It's the same group. All the team members are responsible for all of the team. It's not just like one manager in an office that's going to, you know, call you in for your yearly review. Like we're constantly looking at the chart, we're constantly having conversations. As Michael said earlier, the feedback is pretty constant around here. And all of this is taken into account. We kind of have a general idea. Each person has an idea of like what it means to be a certain level on the board. And we basically are doing kind of self-assessments, right? And it's a combination really of a self-evaluation, like where do I feel I am? And then also the team doing an evaluation on where they think you are. And it's kind of a thing where the team will advocate for you if they are ready to move you up. You know, one person might be strongly moved and then go around and get input. Hey, Michael might be ready to move to, you know, associate three. What do you think about this? And then we'll hear stories and we'll share feedback. And no matter what the decision really is behind the ultimate, whether he moves up or not, Michael will receive a whole bunch of very useful feedback from a lot of the team regarding it. and things to work on. So, and we'll have the exact same thing around, you know, if we have to, if something's not quite working out right, or, you know, attendance might be a problem or something like that, to where we have to have conversations to the other extreme, the approach is pretty much the same.
So somebody on the team, if I understand this, somebody on the team usually, either it might be the individual in a promotional situation that says, hey, you know, maybe you start having some conversations with your pair or with a teammate saying, you know, I feel like I'm getting close to being ready for a move up. Like, what do you think? And then that person, if they feel strongly about it, might sort of trigger or sort of start collecting some feedback about the individual. Or the alternative might be if you're paired with someone who you think maybe, you know, isn't, or you've working with someone who doesn't feel like a good fit, or you think maybe isn't, to go the other way, which hopefully isn't super common, but you would do the same thing. You'd initiate some conversations and gather some information to sort of help the team make a decision. Am I understanding that correctly?
That summary is a pretty good summary. I would like to add two more things. The first one is of which is, once the team bestows on you a level increase, I have not heard any evidence and never witnessed anybody actually be moved back down the roles. So there, it's kind of I won't say it's like a one-way street, but there is that element. We strive really hard to make sure that once you get to a certain role, you're delivering those expectations and that value on a consistent basis.
Sure.
Before we grant you that situation.
Michael, from in any observations from your, you know, tenure, your short tenure there so far, about kind of this process and the transparency and what that has felt like to you, or, you know, in interpreting or experiencing that. So, like, I'm curious if you've had any experiences with that as of yet.
Yeah. So I guess one of the ways I think the just kind of like radical transparency that we have here has kind of surprised me. One of the things we do is, in addition to just, you know, everyone knows how much everyone else is paid and so on, we also know all of the accounting is open book as well. So we have a giant board, which basically everyone participates in, basically filling out from week to week all the different metrics of basically our finances and where we are, which at first I thought it was really weird, but then I was like, wow, this is actually really kind of empowering to me as an employee, because I know, like, you know, what direction the company's heading and like what I can expect for myself personally. Because at my previous job, I was completely distant from that. Like, I never interacted with even the salespeople, let alone the finances or anything. So one day they're just like, oh, by the way, tomorrow's your last day because we don't have enough money to keep you on anymore. I was just like, you know, blindsided. Here it's like I know that everyone's going to be honest with me, and like I'll know that as soon as anyone else knows. Like it's very comforting.
Well, and I'm assuming that probably creates a sense of, you know, a feeling of ownership or connection or buy-in, because you can see how the company's doing, and you know, you know, if there were, you know, you'd know long before a decision got to that point that, hey, we need to do something creative, if, you know, because we're trending the wrong way or whatever. That I would assume that there's a real sense of ownership that comes from that.
Yeah. And another way that we kind of drive that sense of ownership is basically, since everyone participates in the kind of like weekly accounting meeting, and everyone has a different line on the board, which is just one specific metric. Like, you know, one of them might be like, okay, how many hours of developer work did we bill this week? And everyone's job is, if you're tracking that metric, your job is to try to influence that in the positive direction. So you kind of have in the back of your head, it's like, okay, what can I do to make this better? And everyone's always doing that in their own way. So I think you're right. It definitely does. You know, you have a stake in the entire company.
Sure. Well, guys, time is flying by. I could have a conversation with you about all of these things that would probably last 3 or 4 hours. There's just so many interesting things to cover, but I think we've hit some really cool stuff. So as we close, one of the things I ask all of my guests is, I ask for a little bit of insight or advice maybe that others can use. So I will put this question to you. Based on your experience working at Menlo and what that's been like, is there one piece of advice or insight that you would share with the folks that are listening to this that you think might help them as they think about how to create a more human-friendly work experience for their employees? Chris, I'll come to you first.
Yeah, so one of the things that I guess that just makes it so like nice to work here at Menlo, you know, there's the culture, there's the the we work only 40 hours. There's, you can go through the whole list of, you know, all the wonderful things about Menlo. But I have to say, one of the key things about this place more than any other place that I've actually worked for is the fact that, like, you know, I wake up in the morning, you know, everyone wakes up in the morning, you know, you get dressed, you get, you know, breakfast if you're able to or want to, right? You do all the normal things. And you get to a point and in the morning, pretty much every day, right? And, you know, I wake up and it's like, I get to work at Menlo. I like that there's that urge of like, I want to be here. I want, you know, it's fun. It's exciting. It's always fresh. And it's just, I guess, you know, that differed from like all the other places I went to where, you know, you kind of had a little bit of a brief like, oh man, I gotta go to work. It's Monday, you know, right? And I guess the environment that we've got in place here just it allows like a next level of bonds, trust, vulnerability, you know, be yourself, you know, can really be taken to like the next level. You know what I mean? Because you don't have to like work in with the fear that like one little action and I'm in trouble. The developers aren't in an environment where things tend to edge into like kind of maybe even I hate to use the term cutthroat, but you know, sometimes you might be working in an environment where you have a good idea and to some extent, maybe you're afraid to share it because, you know, someone might borrow it or steal it or, sure. You know, I don't know. There's all those different scenarios that just working here does not exist. So
right.
I guess in summary, the advice that I can really give is that, you know, to use the book is called Joy Inc. for a reason. Rich wanted to find a way to bring joy back into the workplace. And I know you can't just flick a switch and, you know, change the culture of an organization, right? But small steps, small things, don't be afraid to run the experiment, we say here, right? Yep. Find little ways to just kind of improve.
Yep. Yep.
Improve traction, right? Because that's there's a poster around here and I don't know where it is, but it literally says something to the tune of, you know, people aren't afraid of change. They're afraid of being changed. And so that's the tidbit that I was going to leave the viewers with today. Like, keep that in mind when, you know, things happen at your particular workplaces or wherever you're at in the world. And
awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for that. Michael, any thoughts to add?
Yeah. I mean, you kind of stole what I was going to say.
No.
No, it's okay. Yeah. If you're listening to this and you're thinking like, oh, we can't, you know, that's crazy. We can't do pairing. We can't do all of these, you know, we can't rearrange that dramatically. Like, we can never do this. Again, like, you know, find what you can do, like find ways that you can align basically the goals of the business with, you know, how the employees act every day and try to, you know, make those kind of positive reinforcements. And again, don't be afraid to run the experiment, like say that, oh, we'll try this, we'll try that. Because, I mean, and just see what sticks and what little positive changes you can make. I think that's like the best advice I could give.
That is awesome. The way I interpret that is, you know, go buy the book, read the book, learn about ideas, and then start hacking your culture, right? Start making small changes and see what happens and see what works. So that is terrific advice. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today. It is so great to hear. You know, it's a treat to kind of hear about an exceptional culture from those who are experiencing it and living in it. So I really appreciate you making the time to share the story and tell us a little bit about how work works at Menlo. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Jason.
All right. And for everybody listening, thank you again for joining us. I do highly encourage, if you want to dive a little bit deeper, Rich Sheridan really did a great job of unpacking both the what, why, and how under the Menlo culture with Joy Inc. I encourage you to go find that, check it out, or go read a little bit more about their culture at menloinnovations.com. And I will see you next time. Thank you. Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Human Friendly Workplace. If you'd like to connect with me to share feedback or recommend a future guest, please email me at jason@jasonlortzen.com. That's jason@jasonlortzen.com. And a very special thank you to Small Improvements for making today's podcast possible. If you enjoyed it, you can thank us by subscribing wherever you get your favorite podcasts and recommending it on to others who you think might find it worthwhile. We'll see you next time.